My name is Ben Burrell, and welcome back to Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. Welcome to episode 2 on Blonde on Blonde. Thank you for your messages on the first episode. On this one, we're having a look at the next two songs and also the album's recording process, which is quite protracted at times, but an interesting interesting process to go through to get a record like this. And we'll get to that in just a second. First, though, thank you to everyone that has signed up for the Patreon show. This is a little bonus show I'm bringing to you. There's quite a bit up there now, actually, quite a few episodes. There's an episode looking at the Daniel Lanois production techniques. There's also an episode looking at Ballad of Thin Man and Up to Me, a couple of brilliant songs. There's an interview with Scarlett Rivera on there. And most recently, a look at Mama, You've Been On My Mind and Dylan's relationship with his first girlfriend, Suze, who inspired that song. We have a look at their relationship and what she did for him and how she kind of really helped to make an early Dylan. If you want to get involved with the Bob Dylan Album by Album extra show on Patreon, then the link is in the episode's description. Let's give a shout out to some people that have been doing just that. Hi to Michael Roth. Nice one for getting involved. Hi Jenny J. Hello to Jesse Scott. Hi Joey Bland. Hello Neil Morris. Jim Ziegler. Hello. Hi Mo Rottenberg. Hello to Richard, who is a singer-songwriter, by the way, that goes by the name of Too Tall. Check him out, he's brilliant. Hi to Jim Marshall, hi to Martin Moran, hi to Johnny Evans, and hi to Scott Leslie too. You can sign up to the Patreon show, Bob Dylan Album by Album Extra. You get bonus shows, you get a show every 2 weeks. You also get a shout out on this show, you get loads of content on the Patreon feed as well. And of course, you support the show and keep it going too. It's the same price as buying like a pint a month if you live in London. 2 pints if you live anywhere else, because London's insanely expensive. But give it a go and support the show. The link is in the episode's description. Let's get to episode 2 on 1966's Blonde on Blonde. On the 14th of February 1966, Bob Dylan walked into Columbia's Studio B complex in Nashville, Tennessee. He was frustrated, tired, and in need of a refresh. The previous run of sessions in his adopted hometown of New York had been a failure. After a lot of studio hours, he'd only emerged with one song for his forthcoming album. Luckily, it was a good one, and it was one that would help shape what would become an era-defining album. While One of Us Must Know, Sooner or Later, isn't the defining song from Blonde on Blonde, neither sonically nor lyrically, I mean it doesn't have the late-night elegant beauty of Visions of Johanna or the aerodynamic pop of I Want You, but it does give us the album's biggest chorus. It, for me, is possibly the only chorus that can match Like a Rolling Stone's Freight Train of Sounds. I know I might be alone in this, but I kind of prefer the hook here. I'm not saying it's a better or bigger song, but hook for hook, it might just go to the Blonde on Blonde track for me personally. Both songs could fill Shea Stadium twice over with their sound, but whereas Like a Rolling Stone has that punky howl, One of Us Must Know has a punching the air quality that shrugs off heartbreak in a single deft chord shift. Both songs are some of the poppiest Dylan has ever gone, and they both start in a similar way as well with that snare hit. They also have that pre-chorus, a little musical bridge that leads us to the hook perfectly. However, once again, for me, in that pre-chorus, in that bridge, One of Us Must Know has a little more about it. Again, I'm not comparing songs, especially when Like a Rolling Stone is the song that it is, both in terms of it being a song and its wider context, but that rush as we go into the chorus of One of Us Must Know is electrifying. It doesn't hold your hand like we get in a lot of songs bringing you to the chorus. It sweeps you at light speed with that rush of Bobby Gregg's drums pounding with glee and a clattering piano that tries to toe the line before exploding into a cascading riff that takes flight over the chorus lines. It's Dylan's vocal that finishes it all off, though. It's one of my favourite moments on the LP. His vocals are uninhibited here. It sounds like he feels every single word. This is a proper performance, not just a cut. And it's a performance that peaks at the end of the song, before his harmonica takes over as a more than capable understudy.
And I told you as you clawed out my eyes, said I never really meant to do you any harm. But sooner or later, one of us must know that you just did what you're supposed to do.
Lyrically, this song is similar to others from around this time. There's a hint of those bitter songs that Dylan was penning in this era, most notably Positively 4 Streets. But there's also some of those breakup songs too. Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat was the other song in this session, and She's Your Lover Now from the previous Fruitless session that we heard about in the last episode of this podcast, they all feel like they're coming from a similar place to this one. It's a breakup song, but like we've seen so many times with Dylan, he doesn't just go down the well-trodden route of painful heartbreak or lover done me wrong. Of course he does that too many times in his career, but he's always been good at doing other stuff along the idea of heartbreak too. Here we have a bitter breakup song that never stews too much. Our narrator is annoyed and upset, but he's over it. He's cutting ties and he's letting his subject know, but he's also apologising at times too. It's not from a bitter place like Positively 4 Streets, it's from a place of acceptance. There's also some great Dylan wit. He sings, "I didn't mean to make you so sad, you just happened to be there, that's all," which is delivered to us early on. But it's not all tongue-in-cheek, there's some anguish here as well. The chorus lines are very straightforward, but still excellent. He sings, "But sooner or later one of us must know that you did what you're supposed to do. Sooner or later one of us must know that I really did try to get close to you." It's a song about hindsight, about how both will come to see this relationship could have been great, but that's ruined now. Those chorus lines weren't the original lines at all. In the very first takes of the song, Dylan actually sings, "Now you're glad it's through and you aren't feeling so mad. Now I think you tried, but I didn't mean to hurt you so bad." So the original concept, while still from that position of hindsight, was perhaps that this relationship is over because our narrator hurt his subject. Later things get softened, well, for our narrator anyway. As Dylan zeroed in on the final lines that we get on the completed LP, he also sang, "Sooner or later, one of us must know that you just did what you had to do. Sooner or later, one of us must know that I really wasn't that bad to you." He changes the lyrics a lot for this song, which, as we'll see, was a reoccurring theme for Blonde on Blonde. Dylan was writing as he went, and that would only get more common as the sessions went on and time ran out. The early lyrics for the song read like an apology. The chorus's final line on an early take was, "But I didn't mean to hurt you so bad," which was then changed for, "That I really wasn't that bad to you," to finally almost the complete opposite of the original line with, "That I really did try to get close to you." Our narrator goes from confessing wrongdoing to saying, "I wasn't actually that bad," to then saying, "Well, actually, do you know what? It's your fault. I tried to get close to you. I tried to get close, but actually, you were the one in the wrong." He also subs the word "hurt" for "treat" elsewhere, again softening that blame. It's a song that ends up being a slightly muted apology, a hug and move on type of goodbye, but with a little sorrow and a little bit of gripe. This song, like the two other breakup songs I've mentioned, has been connected to socialite Edie Sedgwick, which could fit easily. I have my reservations about her as an inspiration, but if a song was going to be about her, it feels like it would be on Blonde on Blonde. This album has more of a theme of love and heartache than the others in this era. Having said that, it could just as easily be about Joan Baez. The "goodbye for good" line found on this song might be a reference to their relationship, which had begun to strain around this point, although more on that later. Elsewhere the line, "But you said you knew me and I believed you did, when you whispered in my ear and asked me if I was leaving with you or her," could easily be the love triangle of Joan, Dylan and his soon-to-be wife Sarah. Or it could be Edie, Sarah and Dylan. Or it could be Dylan, Sarah and Edie. Or even Joan, Sarah and Edie. I mean, who knows at this point. Dylan was having a lot of relationships, it's fair to say. For me though, Baez does seem to be the person that cuts particularly deep for Dylan. They did 24 takes of this song in New York that day, and like the other Big Apple sessions, it wasn't all plain sailing. They recorded from 2:30 till 5:30 p.m, and then again from 7 till 10 p.m, and then again from 11:30 till 2:30 a.m. They recorded 82 minutes of audio with only 5 complete takes of the song. There was a whole lot of rehearsal and some breakdowns, but finally they captured a great version. After a lot of misfires, the fourth New York session had finally resulted in something. But it wasn't enough to keep Dylan in his former creative home. Like we saw in the last episode, the failure of the New York sessions and that band meant that he needed a change. 19 days later, Bob was in Tennessee. And on the very first day's sessions in his new home, they doubled New York's productivity, recording from 2 till 9:30 p.m. and finishing with 2 songs completed for the LP. Dylan left that night with the album back on track on only his first day. That day marked the beginning of Dylan's relationship with a new creative home, but the rejuvenation that Nashville brought had actually been quite a long time coming. Johnny Cash had recommended Nashville to Dylan quite early on. Cash was no stranger to the studio Dylan would end up using. He was even on the Nashville wing of the Columbia label. Despite Dylan being the ultimate New York hipster and Nashville being anything but that, especially at that time, he was sold on Cash's recommendation. A session was scheduled in Nashville in late November 1965, right after the start of the album's recording. This is back around the time when Dylan was cutting Can You Please Crawl Out Your Window. However, this Nashville time was cancelled by the label. Perhaps there was a feeling that having just gone electric and now being a rock star, they didn't want their star man to change his sound again. They were still in the eye of that particular storm. They didn't need Dylan doing something new in Nashville. It might alienate the rest of his fan base. While Cash's advice was blocked by the label, someone else would have better luck. Dylan's journey to Nashville starts on the 29th of July 1965. It was a mild summer day, and Dylan was, of course, at Columbia's recording studios in New York, working on material for Highway 61. He was in the studio a lot at this time. 4 days earlier, he'd been at the infamous Newport Folk Festival. Whilst lots of Dylan's group from the time were present, including musicians Al Kooper and Mike Bloomfield, there was someone missing, Tom Wilson. Wilson had been Dylan's producer. He'd been present on every album from the Freewheeling to Bringing It All Back Home. Basically, every big Dylan album up to this point had had Wilson sat in the control room. For this session, though, he was out, and a new producer was in, Bob Johnston. Wilson was a visionary for the folk rock movement, so it was a surprise he wasn't returning. There's no definitive answer on why this happened, but it could be down to an incident on June the 15th, again, in the studio. During a recording of Like a Rolling Stone, the band went into the control room to listen to the song's playback. Dylan apparently famously said, "Turn the organ up," to which Wilson replied, "Hey man, that cat's not an organ player." Which, as we all know, is true. Al Kooper wasn't an organ player. It's one of rock's great stories. And as we know, he'd struck gold on that first outing. Kooper says in his autobiography that Bob said, "Hey now, don't tell me who's an organ player and who's not. Just turn it up." Apparently the two had had disagreements before. Bob didn't want to call his fourth album Another Side of Bob Dylan. That was Wilson's idea. He explains in the liner notes of the Biograph box set, "I thought it was kind of overstating the obvious." He goes on to say, "It seems like a negation of the past, which just wasn't true. Tom meant well and he had control, so he had his way." Wilson also booked a session without Dylan and without his knowledge in 64. He was overdubbing some instruments onto Dylan's acoustic cuts. All the songs were rejected. All this led to the eventual dismissal of the producer. Johnston was called in by a record exec and told that Wilson was going to be sacked. The actual reason given was that Albert Grossman, Dylan's manager, didn't like Wilson, apparently. Johnston, being a man of character, told Wilson, to which he replied, "Hell, I knew that anyway." He asked if he could be the producer, to which Wilson said, "Be my guest. I'm out of here." There's similarities between both producers. They're a similar age for a start. They're both from Texas. They both end up in New York. But their sounds, they're very different. Wilson was a jazz guy and Johnston was a rocker. Take a song like Maggie's Farm and compare it to Ballad of a Thin Man. You can hear the difference straight away in those songs. Maggie's Farm has that metallic ruckus about it, whereas Ballad of a Thin Man has sonics of a more spacious dynamism. They also differ in approaches. Johnston is quoted as saying he is an artist producer. I quote, give my artist a lot of freedom, he said. Some producers designate a sound to their artists. They dream up a concept to sell them. Johnston is more of a facilitator by many accounts. Like George Martin for the Beatles, he's an important creative force, but in the way of working out what the artist wants the sound to be, not what he thinks it should be. Perhaps at this high point in his career, that's what Dylan needed. He didn't need someone to tell him what to do. He needed someone to help him get to where he wanted to be. His relationship with Dylan seems to have been a strong one. In 2006, Johnston said that he met Dylan in the studio. He was, quote, hunched over. He apparently looked up at Johnston, to which Johnston said, I'm Bob Johnston. He said, I'm Bob Dylan. And Johnston said he smiled at me that day, and I don't think I had anything but a smile from him for the next 8 years. He stayed with me for that long. I still can't believe it. With Johnston in place, they cut Highway 61, but he always wanted to take Dylan to Nashville. He said, I was standing there with Bob and his manager Albert Grossman and Clive Davis and the president of Columbia Records, Bill Gallagher, and I said, Dylan, you've got to go down to Nashville sometime. They've got this great studio down there. They straightened it all out. I made sure they got rid of all those little rooms with a saw and sledgehammer, so now there's just one big room. The musicians are great there, and you can do anything you want to, all in the room together. Apparently, Dylan replied with a casual, Johnston said Bob would sometimes never ask you, but he would put his thumb on his chin and think about what you said. In this case, he ended up just leaving the room. And Grossman, Davis and Gallagher came over to Johnston and said, if you ever mention Nashville to Bob again, you're fired. Johnston says he asked why, and he was told, quote, because we don't want him working with a bunch of goddamn stupid people down there. You've got him good here, and it looks like we're going to have a great record, so let's keep it that way, and just remember what we told you. Johnston says he replied with, yeah, okay, you're the boss. However, 7 months later, after the New York difficulties, Johnston got his wish. I think this illustrates just how bad things were in New York. Everyone gave in, and Dylan was in Nashville and about to cut the record of his career. The first song they got in his new home was Visions of Johanna.
Ain't it just like the night to play tricks when you're trying to be so quiet? Sit here stranded, we're all doing our best to deny it.
They got it in 4 takes. After 14 failed attempts in New York, Nashville proved to be much more fertile turf. The title was likely inspired by the Jack Kerouac novel Visions of Gerard. Kerouac's influence on Dylan is obviously well known. He has mentioned him many, many times, telling Playboy in 1978 that he was the first major influence on Dylan, along with Allen Ginsberg. There's also nods to T.S. Eliot in the song. While Dylan at times has disassociated himself from Eliot, he's also acknowledged his influence too. Away from giving him a shout-out in the song Desolation Row, where Eliot is having a scrap with Ezra Pound, Dylan also read his poem The Wasteland on his Theme Time Hour radio show, where he was actually worried he'd messed up the line a little bit.
It's just like T.S. Eliot said, April is the cruelest month. His poem, The Wasteland, commemorated the death of Abraham Lincoln. Here's how it begins. April is the cruelest month, breeding. Lilacs out of the dead land mixing, memory and desire stirring, dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth and forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprises coming over the Starnbergersee. Hope I said that one right. With a shower of rain, we stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. April is the cruelest month, breeding. Lilacs out of the dead land mixing. Memory and desire stirring dull roots with spring rain.
Eliot's work Rhapsody on a Windy Night starts at midnight, with the opening line being 12 o'clock, all along the reaches of the street, held in lunar synthesis. Whispering lunar incantations. These are similar to Dylan's lunar bathed lyrics of Ain't It Just Like the Night to Play Tricks When You're Trying to Be So Quiet. We sit here stranded, though we're all doing our best to deny it. 3/4 of the way through Eliot's work, we're greeted with the lines 3:30, the lamp spluttered, the lamp muttered in the dark. In Visions, Dylan sings, mutter small talk at the wall, and the heat pipes cough. Not only do they share occasional words in the same setting, but there's a stillness to both these works, a quiet at their core that feels like it's borne out only from the midnight hour. Dylan's delivery in Johanna is from a narrator who's gazing into a New York evening, spilling his mind onto records. It's the sort of reflection that comes when the stars are out and the world is quieter. I always imagine Dylan in a loft with the famous New York skyline touching the sky, with the lights from the city reflected into a murky fog. I adore the depictions of late night in this song. Pipes coughing a sound synonymous with the wee hours, a night watchman's lonely questioning, and that marvellous opener about the night playing tricks when you're trying to be so quiet. This for me is the very core of good writing. It does it all at once. It's relatable. How many times on just a very base level have we all experienced all three of those things late at night? We've all tried to be quiet and it's seeming like you're being tripped up by the very darkness itself. Especially relatable is our night watchman. If you've ever worked nights, you'll know that feeling of semi-madness. But on a higher level, what it does simultaneously is draw us in as a listener. We instantly understand this scene. We know what that is like. We know what the delicate rattle of pipes in the silent night sounds like, and that helps us instantly be transformed to this scene. Like Dickens when adding detail, Dylan is adept at putting us in the scene and submerging us there in his words. In only a few lines, we are in New York and we are in this evening. No one sets a scene like Dylan. He does it with such ease as well and always uses the right word. For example, when we hear about the light in the opposite loft, it flickers. The light doesn't dance or catch his eye, it flickers. Like candle lights, perfect for this late night scene. It's delicate and muted just like this scene too. It's not an electric light which could hum or be glaring, it's candle lights, it's flickering. Dylan spends the whole verse setting this very scene as he sings, "Lights flicker from the opposite loft. In this room the heat pipes just cough. The country music station plays soft, but there's nothing, really nothing to turn off. Just Louise and her lover so entwined, and these visions of Johanna that conquer my mind." Loft, coughed, soft, turn off, all play into this imagery of late night stillness. It's all dimmed. It's all contemplative. We hear of Louise and her lover entwined, possibly asleep, whilst our narrator is lost in thoughts of Johanna. In fact, that's all he thinks about. Every verse returns to her. In the next verse, Dylan sings, "Louise, she's all right, she's just near. She's delicate and seems like the mirror. But she just makes it all too concise and too clear that Johanna's not here. The ghost of electricity howls in the bones of her face, where these visions of Johanna have now taken my place." The ghost of electricity howls in the bones of her face line is perhaps one of Dylan's best lyrics ever. It, like we saw before, creates such a powerful image. It's like a grand painting for your mind's eye. Dylan always has such a knack for doing this. His turn of phrase, no matter the lack of word count, just seems to be able to conjure up vivid images within an instant. That line captures a face in the half lights. That light lighting the bones of her face, showing what we assume is a quite tired-looking woman. The ghost of electricity, for me, suggests she was once so energetic. Perhaps there was once a spark between her and our narrator, but that is now gone. I always imagine a comedown of sorts being the prelude to this song, whether it's a comedown from drugs, love or fame, who knows. But our narrator and some friends have retired to his loft and they're coming down, slowly returning to the real world. The spark of that time is now faded and they're just left with reflection. Our narrator in this state is still haunted by visions of Johanna. In fact, he confesses things have got so bad that those visions have replaced him as a person. The character of Louise perhaps had a spark for our narrator at one time, but that is now gone. They might have been lovers, but now she is with someone else. It's not a breakup with anger and drama, though. We hear as much in the lines, "Louise, she's all right, she's just near. She's delicate and seems like the mirror. But she just makes it all too concise and too clear that Johanna is not here. She's not a bad person or anything, she's just not Johanna, the one our narrator really loves." It's a lyric that I always feel is paired with a line from 1997, "Standing in the Doorway," as Dylan sings, "Last night I danced with a stranger, but she just reminded me that you were the one." And just to bring it full circle, Daniel Lanois, the producer on the song "Standing in the Doorway," said that one of the early inspirations for that song came from another tune on this album, "Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands." Our narrator is thinking of another lover who's not here, the one he truly wants. But he's stuck in his loft with a former flame and her new lover, and while they're asleep, he reflects on all of this. As we've seen, this was apparently written during a blackout, so while everything else is shut off, our narrator is thinking about life with no distractions. This is brought on by old friends being with him and new lovers not. Like we saw on Highway 61's Carnival of the Strange, Desolation Row, there's madness found in this song too. In the final verse, Dylan sings, "The peddler now speaks to the countess who's pretending to care for him, saying, 'Name me someone that's not a parasite, and I'll go out and say a prayer for him.'" This could easily be a reference to Dylan's life at this point. Parasites appear to be the roots of songs like Fourth Street and Ballad of a Thin Man, and just like in the latter of those songs, we slip in and out of the real world and the surreal in this song. We hear about a jelly-faced woman and jewels and binoculars on the head of a mule, before we end up with the lines, "And Madonna she still has not showed. We see the empty cage now corrode. Where her cape and her stage once flowed. The fiddler he now steps to the road. He writes everything's been returned which was owed. On the back of a fish truck that loads. While my conscience explodes. The harmonica plays the skeleton keys in the rain. And these visions of Johanna are now all that remain." This is all accompanied with some slightly more animated lead guitar, which appropriately gives some surreal undertones to the song, as we're given a blast on the whammy bar.
Once it flowed. The fiddler, he now steps to the road. He writes, everything's been returned which was old. On the back of the fish truck that loads, while my conscience explodes.
Our narrator's weary mind is ravaged after all this thought. Johanna is all that now remains. He's obsessed with her. Louise, who's occupied his time for a while, has lost her touch and he's now consumed by another. But just who is Johanna? Well, as we've heard in the previous episode of this podcast, the song's original name was Freeze Out. Dylan had apparently written it on the 9th of November during the Great Northeast Blackout that knocked out electricity in 8 states. Interestingly, the type of reflection in this song can only come out of a situation like that. Its stillness, its complex rumination, its late night tone, all of it screams blackouts, from the quiet to the feeling of the world just stopping or being in limbo. But freeze out also suggests something else. Freezing someone out is to exclude someone from something. Perhaps our narrator is excluding Louise from his love, so she's found a new lover. That fits with the ghost of electricity line. There was once a spark, but now there's not. Our narrator is consumed by another woman, and his former lover now means nothing to him. This also fits with Dylan's personal situation in a way. He infamously married his first wife, Sarah, in 65, amongst a string of other relationships that were pretty much going on at the time, with everyone from socialite Edie Sedgwick to fellow musician Joan Byers. Byers thinks she is the inspiration for the song. On the 3rd of December, days after failing to get the song onto tape in New York, Dylan performed it at Berklee Community Theatre in California. Byers was there. She says, "First of all, he'd never performed that song live before, but someone told him I was there and he performed it, so that was very odd." Later, she goes on to say, "I'd listen to that song and I'd want to feel flattered. Everyone in the world thinks Bob has written a song about them, and I'm in the same bag, but certain things did seem very strange." She also says that Allen Ginsberg once asked her if she knew what the song was about. She apparently said he reeled off a pile of crap that it was actually about nothing. Byers suspects Dylan and Ginsberg were in cahoots trying to throw her off the song's original meaning. While I always feel that anything Dylan has written could be about absolutely nothing, and sometimes I genuinely think that is the case, sometimes I think it means whatever you want it to mean, and that's kind of enough. But here, Byers does seem overly convinced. She even wrote a song in 1974, included on 1975's Diamonds and Rust, called Winds of the Old Days. That seems to reference this song. She says, "Thank you for righting a few wrongs. You're a savage gift on a wayward bus. But you stepped down and you sang to us. And get you down to the harbour now. Most of the sour grapes are gone from the bough. Ghosts of Johanna will visit you there. And the winds of the old days will blow through your hair." Elsewhere on this album, there's also a cover of Simple Twist of Fate, and on the titular track, Byers sings lines like, "Well, you bust onto the scene, already a legend, the unwashed phenomenon, the original vagabond, you strayed into my arms." There is a compelling argument about this song being about Byers, but also there's a compelling argument to say that it's not about love at all, and Dylan is merely using this as an example to illustrate feelings of alienation. As we'll see over coming episodes, alienation runs throughout Blonde on Blonde, and throughout this era too. Dylan, at the height of his fame, must have felt alienated from people. You can hear that in so many different songs, and this feels like it's another one of those. Back to the actual cuts, and while triumphant lyrically, the song's sonics more than pull their weight. The nocturnal theme of the tune is complemented by the instrumentation. Thankfully, they don't go down any route of cheap tricks. There's no late-night sound effects of an owl, or even a slightly over-obvious jazz club-style guitar playing, which is obviously a good thing. However, they do manage to set a late-night scene within the instrumentation. Cooper's organ sounds like it's been filtered through candlelight. It's not muted, but the sound is diaphanous at times. The stabbed chords on the lead electric guitar make sure we never get a wall of sound, meaning the song's quiet lyrical themes aren't hammered home with a mountain of guitars in the background. This is all kept in time by the drums. They're never played softly, which is almost at odds with everything I've just said. Instead, they're panned in the right ear, which means, just like the guitars, they never overwhelm the sound. But they are actually quite loud at times. Kenneth Buttery gives the track a bit of roughness, with some actually quite heavy playing at times, but he never detracts from the song's sonic tone. His choice to ride the bell cymbal during the harmonica breaks and throughout the song adds not only to a nice shift in percussion, but also acts like a ticking clock. It gives the whole late night scene a quiet, subtle atmosphere. It's like an old grandfather clock ticking away in the background, with the scene of a New York blackout, Louise and her lover asleep, and our narrator slowly losing his mind to another lover as the darkness presses on.
Empty lot where the ladies play. Blind man's bluff with the keychain.
These sonics enhance these lines so much for me that when we compare it to another take that has basically the same lyrics, it sounds a world away. It misses that scene setting. Take 14 from New York, for example. This is found on the Cutting Edge bootleg. While an enjoyable listen, and at times actually a more dynamic take with what sounds like an electric harpsichord present too. But having said that, it's just nowhere near as good, and it doesn't fit the lines just quite as well as the completed Blonde on Blonde version.
In the empty lot where the ladies play blind man's bluff with the keychain. All night girls whisper of escapades out on the D train.
Visions of Johanna came relatively easy in Nashville, and that was a good indicator for the rest of the album. Sessions began there on the 14th of February 66. There's some discrepancies on dates, but let's try and stay out the weeds a little bit this time. Not only was Visions of Johanna cut on that day, but so was Fourth Time Around. The shift in productivity from New York might lead us to believe that this was a slick operation, but actually, that's not the case. Johnston Block booked Studio A in Nashville for Dylan, while Studio B was actually the bigger and better room in the facility. The whole complex had steadily been making its name as a world-class recording base. Hits like Jingle Bell Rock and You Can Make It If You Really Try had been recorded there before Bob came to town. Johnston had also been there recently in December with Simon and Garfunkel, where he cut Homeward Bound. He not only prepared the room, he prepared Dylan's band as well. Some of Dylan's local players remained. Al Cooper and Robbie Robertson, of course, returned for the sessions. But after the issues in New York, there must have been a feeling that new blood was required. But also a pressure to get it right. Johnston assembled a good southern band, as he called it. A band of professionals. A tight, bright, compliant backing group for Bob. One of them was Charlie McCoy, a multi-instrumentalist who had played for all the greats, including Presley and Cash, and has since assembled a bewildering client list. He'd also been described as the most dangerous musician in Nashville at the time, because if he walked into a session, then your job could go like that. He'd previously played with Dylan on Desolation Row, and he was back here for some more magic. In fact, Johnston relied heavily on McCoy. He basically formed the band for him and Dylan. He apparently liked to use two groups of musicians. The first was Wayne Moss on guitar, Kenny Buttery on drums, Bill Aitkins on keyboards. And the second group was Moss and Buttery playing along with Hargus Pig Robbins and bassist Henry Strelecki. McCoy was on harmonica or guitar, depending on which he preferred or which the song needed. Johnston also tapped up guitarist Joe South, a singer, songwriter and producer who'd been making waves. They were also briefly joined by another guitarist, Jerry Kennedy, who appeared in the very first Nashville session. On the first day, Dylan's flight was delayed, the first sign to the Nashville players that this wasn't going to be a normal session for them. They were used to three-hour sessions, a professional, punch-the-clock type of atmosphere. This was a creative business, but it was a business nonetheless. Time was money. Robbins remembers the shift for them. He says, "That was totally different from anything I'd done before. We were always so structured. We'd be there at 3 o'clock and we'd start playing and we'd have three country songs. They would book Dylan, though, from 6 till 10. And he might not show up till 10 p.m. And he'd say, "Boys, I've got to go and write a song." And we'd have to leave the studio and roam the halls till 1 or 2 in the morning. It was wild. Chris Christopherson, unbelievably, was a studio janitor at the time. He said, "Bob would just sit there all night at the piano, all night. The band would be playing ping pong or whatever they were doing, and then by morning, we'd have this masterpiece." As we've seen before, and as is outlined in those two quotes, Dylan was still writing this LP as they recorded it. I've always found his output during this time incredible. The volume of quality he amassed appears to have been down to a constant production line of writing and then recording almost instantly. There's no 4 or 5 year old songs here. Perhaps that's why all these years later, and all these decades later in fact, these songs still sound so fresh. There's no overthinking, no losing that original magic. McCoy remembers Dylan being apprehensive at the start of that very first session, but also excited to get to work. By the end of it, he was not only pleased with Visions of Johanna, but was happy with Fourth Time Around. He'd challenged the Nashville musicians to capture the song's delicate sound, and they'd responded brilliantly. After striking gold twice on that first day's session, the next day's session didn't quite sparkle in the same way. It was on the 15th, and Dylan wasn't even present. The band ran through the track "I'll Keep It With Mine." You can hear the instrumental takes on the 13 disc of the Cutting Edge bootleg box set. Dylan might have lost interest in the song. After it failed to materialise in New York, he might have thought, this is never going to happen. There's also some suggestion that this is more of a Johnston song. Not in terms of it actually being written by Johnston for Dylan, but apparently it was more in favour in Johnston's camp. So perhaps Dylan didn't feel like it was wholly one of his and was just happy to let it go. Bob himself at the time was in a hotel room downtown working on the lyrics for Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands. By the evening, he was ready. Billy Swan, a country singer who at the time was working in the recording studio emptying ashtrays, had the job of picking Dylan and Cooper up from the hotel and bringing them to the studio. He remembers it being a wet day. He remembers seeing Dylan and Cooper hurdling over puddles when running into the studio from the car, sprinting with off-duty police officers that Johnston had employed for Dylan's protection. It was mid-evening, and you would have thought after working on lyrics for an entire day, the song would be ready to record. But it wasn't. Dylan kept the band on ice until he'd finished those lyrics. As we know, Dylan was writing whilst recording, but there's writing whilst recording, and then there's actually writing as you physically record. Cooper remembers days where Dylan would just sit at the piano writing for 6 hours or so. According to studio logs, it was 4 a.m. when Dylan finally went into the control room and asked if anyone was still awake. This time, he was actually ready. Legend had it the song was done in one take, but it was actually 4. Which, while doesn't quite live up to the myth, is not bad, considering it was literally just written. The first take was complete, then there was a rehearsal, and then 2 more complete takes. The second one of those is what we hear on the record. Not much really changed between them, apart from a small lyrical revision. On the first 2 takes, Dylan sings, "With your mercury eyes and the mouths that climb." But prior to recording the 3rd take, he changed it to the now familiar, "With your mercury mouth" in the Missionary Times. It was actually quite a long, protracted session, but it managed to end with a classic in the bag. He would later go on to tell biographer Robert Shelton it was one of the best songs he ever wrote. It was worth all that effort and all that day's writing. The next day's session was another one-song session. They focused on another lengthy classic, this time stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Once again, the band were kept waiting. They were drinking coffee and playing ping pong, hanging around the studio. Billy Swan even remembers playing Dylan's manager, Albert Grossman, who'd come to watch the session. The wait went on for 10 hours. Johnston recalled years later that he thought Dylan was a junkie. He remembers him ordering milkshakes and candy bars en masse, eating and writing, removed from everyone else. The idea that he was a junkie might not seem too far from the truth. Later, Dylan would say it, quote, takes a lot of medicine to keep up that pace. His amphetamine use at this time is well documented. He wasn't wasting time, though. Whilst he was indulging in stuff like that from time to time, he was also working pretty hard too. This song apparently came from a free association exercise where Dylan wrote a lot of phrases and words that he liked on a typewriter. Some of these read Mama Memphis Blues, People Just Get Uglier, Honky Tonk, Black Lagoon, Waltz, and the last phrase on the page was written in hand. It simply said, chest. It was another 4 a.m. start for the Nashville musicians. They got the call and they assembled in the studio. Dylan was on acoustic guitar and harmonica, and the lineup for this song was McCoy also on acoustic guitar, Moss and South on electric guitars, Robbins on piano, Cooper on organ, Strelecki on bass, and Buttery on drums. They got the song in 18 takes. The 7-minute epic of Stuck Inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues again was completed. The first run of Nashville sessions for Dylan was done too. A cold morning greeted the musicians as they left the studio that day. Many returned in only a few hours to normal artist sessions where people recorded music and weren't paid to play ping pong. For Dylan, though, he was off. He had live dates to tend to. But he must have been feeling good. Nashville had been a success so far. They had made the right decision. He captured a lot of songs already and some of the album's longest tracks too, which, when you're recording like this, is important. With over half an hour of music already in the can, Blonde on Blonde was finally shaping up. Dylan returned to Nashville on the 7th of March. He played dates in New York, Jacksonville and Montreal, and this time he came back to his new recording base with his wife Sarah and new son Jesse. He took both of them into the session. On arrival, he told Bob Johnston that he was still working on a song that they would probably record later that day. It was Where Are You Tonight, Sweet Marie, or as it would be known, Absolutely, Sweet Marie. Once again, Dylan worked on the tune with the musicians on ice. This time they waited 7 hours. It was getting ridiculous, remembers Moss. McCoy said of the session, it was hard to remain upbeat and keep focused. The novelty of being paid to do nothing was wearing off. Around 9:30 or 10, Dylan realised his harmonicas didn't make it to Nashville with him on his return, so Johnston asked Chris Christopherson to borrow some harps from a Nashville singer-songwriter called Chris Gantry. Gantry lived not too far from the studio, and even after they fetched his harmonicas, it wasn't until 1 a.m. that Dylan was finally ready. They got Sweet Marie on the third proper take. They tweaked the tempo up a little bit on this final take, and it seemed to make the song get over the line. After all this waiting round, the song actually came very quickly in the studio. The next day, unsurprisingly, there was yet more waiting rounds. Gantry, perhaps seeing how his harmonicas were getting on, popped by the session around 2 p.m. and he remembers there was not a lot going on at all. As a professional musician, he was shocked. They were all waiting round to record a classic, Just Like a Woman. It was a song Dylan began writing in Kansas City at Thanksgiving and was still writing today. Once Dylan was happy with the lyrics, he was ready to record once again. The lineup that afternoon was Dylan on vocals, Charlie McCoy on acoustic guitar, Joe South on electric guitar, Pig Robbins on piano, Al Cooper on organ, Strelecki on bass, and Kenneth Buttery on drums. Robbie Robertson remained in the control room for now. When they were ready to record a take, Johnston from the control room asked, "What's the name of this one, Bob?" To which Bob replied, "Like a Woman." And then they were off. They cut 4 versions before a break at 6 p.m. At first, Dylan had all the choruses in second person, so you was present instead of she. Lines read, "And you fake just like a woman, and you ache just like a woman, and you break just like a little girl." There was other minor changes elsewhere. There was a honey instead of a baby, and it was Annie, not Queen Mary, who's the friend mentioned in the song. And there was no trace of fog or amphetamine in that pearls line as of yet. That read, "But I gave you those pearls." The lines on the bridge also changed too as the recording went on. And so does the sound of the song as well. The first take is quite tranquil, with the mix focusing on a rhythm guitar and the drums quite sidelined. It's a much more intimate affair with a twinkling piano and some fluid lead guitar. As always, you can find it on the Cutting Edge bootleg.
Lately I see her ribbons and her bows have fallen from her curls.
On the fourth take of the song, Robertson went into the studio and they mixed it up a little. They injected a bit of pace with a Bow Diddley rhythm and a nice Dylan delivery.
It was me who gave you those pearls. Yes, you shake like a woman, and you wake like a woman, but you break just like a little girl.
While not a bad take, in fact, actually quite an enjoyable one, it still wasn't quite there. At one point in the take, Dylan says, "We lost it, man," laughing, and from that moment on, they shelved it, intending to move on. But first, there was a break. Dylan went off to, guess what? That's right, write some more. The band, as usual, killed time. Strzelecki remembers a Ouija board being brought in. They messed around on it for a while, and he remembers at one point saying, "You know what? This album is either going to be the biggest album in the world, or it's going to do nothing." And actually, he was right. In reality, the sessions so far haven't really oozed the confidence of a masterpiece in waiting. Sure, the music was sounding great, and now in Nashville they were getting work done, but it all seems a bit haphazard, a bit last minute. Not for the first time in this era, Dylan was running on fumes. Literally, at times. For the musicians, though, they were cutting songs with one of the biggest and most important stars in the world, but they were also hanging around. So much so they did anything to keep themselves amused. Cooper remembers there being a game of flicking quarters into the ceiling tiles, lodging them there. Imagine if your grandkid asked you what it was like cutting this record and your first thought was, "Well, we had this game with a quarter that we'd throw into the ceiling." Even great art has its mundane sides. Finally, it was recording time again. With Just Like a Woman shelved, they began work on a song called What Can You Do for My Wigwam, which was the working title of Pledging My Time. They got it in four takes, a breakdown, a rehearsal, a full start, and then the complete version, done and dusted and ready for the record. It was time to go back to Just Like a Woman. The lyrics were pretty much done by this stage, the perspectives had shifted, and some lines had been finessed. Sonically, they ditched the up-tempo idea and Robertson went back into the control booth. They reverted to a more ballady-sounding idea. They tried different slow tempos again with Dylan singing, and they also tried dropping the drums out, to which Dylan stopped the take immediately shouting, "No, I think the drums should be there. I can't sense this without the drums." While still not there, they were definitely getting closer. They'd started to capture complete takes of the song with only minor issues. The tempo always seemed a little off, or the intro wasn't quite right, or Joe South hit a bum note. Finally, it came on take 18. With a slightly faster tempo and a stunning performance from everyone, it was done. Dylan stopped the session. "We're done," he said. The 11th Blonde on Blonde session was finished. It was actually a relatively early finish, around midnight, but the musicians would need a rest and a good night's sleep because tomorrow they were in for a marathon. Dylan and the Nashville musicians returned to the studio at 6 p.m. on Wednesday the 9th of March and didn't leave until sunup the following morning around 7 a.m. There they would finish Blonde on Blonde. In 13 hours of recording time, they would cut 6 songs. The clock was ticking. First up was most likely You Go Your Way and I'll Go Mine. While there were 6 takes, the arrangement was more or less there from the start, and after a complete take and some rehearsals, they had it. It was 9 p.m. and a song was already in the can. From here, they quickly captured Temporary Like Achilles, which was done by midnight. It once again was a song that had only just been written. Dylan finally found a home for the 2-line chorus that had been knocking around since the first Blonde on Blonde sessions in New York. It was a line that read, "Well, I know you want my loving, mama, but you're so hard." The phrase, "Honey, But It's Just So Hard," had appeared at the top of the Stuck Inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues Again transcript. After some moving around of the lyrics and a higher tempo, the song was finished. In the early hours of the 10th, they began work on Rainy Day Women. As we heard in the last episode of this podcast, there was late night dispatches for some more brass, and the song was done in one take. By this stage, they were on a roll. It happened so fast that Robertson, who'd gone down to the lounge to buy a packet of cigarettes, missed it entirely. But he would be present for the next song. Obviously, Five Believers is where they turned their attentions next. Robinson turns in a brilliant performance on the song's two complete takes, the second of which makes it onto the LP. After being sidelined for parts of this session, he shone and everyone knew it. Robinson remembers, "After we cut it, everyone came over. Everyone came up to me and said, 'That's wicked, that's fantastic.' They really embraced me into the club." The role continued with Robinson chipping in too. From here, they wouldn't be stopped. Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat was another one-take wonder. They had attempted it on that very first day in Nashville where Visions of Johanna was cut. That session included takes that were menacingly bluesy and a take that featured a car horn and a phone ringing.
"Who's there? Well, I see you got your brand new Leopard Skin Pillbox head. Yes, I see you got your
But this time round, they stripped all that away and launched into it, and it was done. It was almost like Dylan had been processing it in the back of his mind ever since that first session, and it was just ready to go instantly. As they played the final bars of the song, Johnston came on the talkback mic and said, "Okay," then shouted, "Next." As the music stopped, McCoy turned to Robinson and said, "Robbie, the whole band will marry you after that." Robinson was apparently coming into his own in this session, just as the session itself was peaking, giving it all one final push as it came to a close. And it came to a close with "I Want You." With dawn just round the corner, they ran through the song. Cooper loved it and had an idea for the arrangement. When I was running the songs over with Bob, my favourite was "I Want You" because I had this whole arrangement in my head, he explains. And Bob knew that it was my favourite, so he waited till the end of the session. He made me suffer. Dylan was backed on the track with Buttery on drums, Moss on electric guitar, McCoy on acoustic guitar, Robbins on piano, Strelecki on bass, and Cooper on organ. Unsurprisingly, it was all done very quickly, with not much planning. At one point, Johnston announces, "Okay, I want you, take one." McCoy immediately pipes up, "Wait a minute, hold on, we haven't decided on the intro, have we?" Dylan turns to him and says, "The intro is just the..." and then strums the chords. And that's it, they're off. Cooper directed Wayne Moss on the idea he'd had, and it worked. By the fifth take, everyone was happy. Cooper recalls being particularly impressed with the Nashville players in that session. They couldn't have done that in New York, he remembers. It was 7 a.m, and the southern dawn came over the river bridge, and Blonde on Blonde was finished. In one mad night, they'd finished off a mad run of sessions, a run that at times failed to keep up with itself. It was also constantly at odds with itself. It was mundane yet thrilling. It was busy yet had endless periods of waiting rounds. As the musicians left that morning and went to bed, they must have all felt like Strelecki. This was either going to be a classic or a mess. This is, though, mid-60s Dylan, so obviously it was going to be a classic. As for Dylan, well, like he always did, he went back to work. He left Nashville later that day for a gig in St. Louis the following night. He took with him one of the first double albums in rock history. But what was the sound they actually captured in Nashville? That's something we look at next time.
Undertaker sighs, the lonesome organ grinder cries, the silver saxophones say I should refuse you.
That is it for this episode. As always, thank you so much for listening. I loved researching the Nashville musicians and what the environment in the studio was like, because well, actually, I was quite pleased that it was slightly chaotic and slightly mundane. I love that a great album's come out of that situation. So yeah, it was fun making this episode. Hope you enjoyed listening to it. If you are listening in a place right now where you can review and rate the podcast, please do. We've had so many of these down the years now, but it's always good to have a few more. So feel free to get involved. I always say 4 stars or above. No need to go under 4 stars. That's fine. 4 or above is fine for me. And write a little review as well. That really helps us out. Nice one for listening. I will be back next week with episode 3 on Blonde on Blonde. We'll look at the next 2 songs and also the famous artwork. We'll get to that next time. In the meantime, take care.
A Fueled by Coffee production.